doctors bamboozled by jargon, blinded by science, and turning to Google in the hope it'll become your new best friend. Well, this is the concept behind Naked Health. It's to strip medicine right back down to its basics, to cut out the jargon, tell it as it is, and really make it accessible to everybody. My name is Penny Ward, and I currently work as a GP. I feel that in my role, I'm touched by so many lives, so many stories and experiences. I want to take you on these journeys with me, seen through my eyes as a doctor, but told using the voices of everyday people. Lung cancer carries a huge burden. Not only is it the most commonly diagnosed cancer and the leading cause of cancer deaths worldwide, it also carries a stigma. Society's negative perception and the implicit association between lung cancer and smoking, the idea that the disease is somehow self-inflicted. This bias is real and exists in patients, caregivers, healthcare providers, and the public. Yes, smoking is a risk factor for many cancers, heart disease, and strokes, yet the tendency to blame the smoker occurs most often with lung disease. Did you know half of those who die from lung cancer were never smokers or had given up many years before they actually became ill? Today, I speak to an advocate, someone who confronts and challenges this stigma and bias. I speak with Heather, diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, fit, weighing 130 pounds and aged 34 years old. Heather is a non-smoker. Today, I have a really exciting guest joining me, and I think it's fair to say that with COVID lockdown, I'm able to branch out hugely in terms of who I speak to. So today, I'm joined by Heather, all the way from Denver, Colorado. Hello, Heather.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here today.
Tell us a little bit about Denver, where we're all obviously stuck in our gardens or our flats or our houses and can only dream of foreign travel. What's it like in Denver?
So I live in the city limits of Denver, but it is just a regular neighborhood in the U.S. We lived for a long time very near the mountains and spent a lot of time skiing and snowboarding here in Colorado. We're also avid campers and really into kayaking. And it's a beautiful state. It's very much more populated than it was when I was growing up. The face has changed of Denver, but it's still beautiful.
It sounds stunning. The place that dreams are made of, certainly at the moment, I'm sure.
Yes, it is.
I wondered if we could jump into your story, Heather, and you give us a little bit of a background about you and any symptoms that you might have had prior to seeking any sort of professional advice or going to see any doctor several years ago.
Sure. So I was diagnosed with stage 4 ALK positive lung cancer in May of 2016. I was 34 at the time. I had had a persistent cough from a cold I had in the winter, and it just wouldn't go away. At first, I thought it was seasonal allergies, and then it started to get really bad where I would wake up coughing really hard at night. I couldn't catch my breath. I couldn't laugh because it would cause me to cough. I was uninsured at the time, so we're a little different in the US where we pay for our insurance. And I had made a choice when I got the job that I have now to be uninsured because I was 34 and I was otherwise healthy. It was very cost prohibitive to be insured through a firm that I was working with at the time. So as they hired me on as a full-time employee and insurance was within the price range, I immediately went to see my primary care physician. Initially, she treated me for allergies, pneumonia, and bronchitis. And I think that she was probably my biggest advocate right at the beginning. She knew that something was wrong. And she told me straight from the beginning, I think this is something more. She ordered a chest x-ray. The chest x-ray image came back. And basically, it looked like my entire right lung was filled up with like the filaments of cotton candy. And after that chest x-ray, immediately they sent me in for an MRI and a PET scan. And then I had a bronchoscope, which is I was intubated and they went down my, you know, where I breathe, and they took a sample of my tissue, sent the sample out and confirmed it was lung cancer, and it had spread to my brain and my ovaries. And then the tissue testing said that I was ALK positive. So of the giant pie of lung cancer, right, if we're looking at the pie, about of the adenocarcinoma lung cancer, the whole pie, a very small portion is caused by smoking. And I would love to tell every single person that I've ever met and ever will meet that anyone with lungs can get lung cancer. It is not preventable. And so of that giant pie of my particular type of lung cancer, the ALK genetic mutation, about 3 to 4% of people have it. And I felt very lucky and blessed that I had that, because my treatment was not a traditional chemo route. Instead, I take a targeted therapy. I like to think of this therapy as a sniper, right? It goes in and it guns down just that one rogue cell. However, my body at some point will overcome my targeted therapy. And that means that I will have disease progression.
I love the way that you describe that with a sniper taking down the cells, because it's so hard actually for people to understand the different types of treatment and how they're specifically targeted to different types of cancers and how that decision is made in terms of treatment. Can I just go back to the cough that you had? Approximately how long do you think you'd had it for? Because I know loads of us get coughs, don't we, after colds, and then our sinuses start to play up. How long was it until you realized that potentially the cough was something more serious?
I had had the cough on and off probably for about a year. But again, I had a cold over the winter and then it was allergy season. Yeah, it was probably about a year period. But from the time I was insured, which is in November of 2015, my day of diagnosis was May 2016. So it was only like, 5 months? And that was the time when I was going in, and I was very persistent with my primary care physician, and she was also very persistent. So I think maybe that seems like a long time, but for me, that was a very short time period.
Yeah. The key here, you were a fit, healthy 34-year-old who just wasn't on your radar at all. And I'm sure it's not on a lot of people's radar when you're that age that potentially it could be something so serious.
That's absolutely right.
Did you have any suspicions yourself when you went to see your primary physician that it potentially could be cancer, or was that like a complete bolt from the blue to you?
It was a complete surprise. However, my primary care physician said, there is something wrong and it's not good. I, however, have, this is actually my second cancer. I had a dermatofibrosarcoma protuberance, which is essentially, I had cells, it's similar to like a skin cancer where the cells went rogue again, but they were able to completely remove it. And what I've learned about myself is that I don't present normally. So it was a long adventure. And I did not think it was going to be cancer. I thought it was going to be something weird, something strange, something really rare, because that's just how I am medically.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. And what are the chances realistically that you're going to have cancer twice by the age of 34?
Right.
I just wanted to pause and speak a little bit about what the various stages of cancer are and what they mean. So when we think of staging of cancers, it's a way that we have of describing the size of a cancer, but how far it's also grown. So stage one means that a cancer is relatively small. It's contained to the place where it started. Stage two is bigger. The cancer, the tumour, is bigger, but it hasn't started to spread to any of the surrounding tissues. that there are a few different types of cancer where it can mean that some of the lymph nodes next to the tumour have been affected. Stage 3 means that the cancer is bigger still and it started to spread to the surrounding tissues, and there are cancer cells which are now found in the lymph nodes next to where the tumour started. So Heather speaks about being diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And what stage 4 cancer means is that the cancer has spread from where it started to distant parts of the body. And you might have heard it called secondary cancer or metastatic cancer. As a general rule, cancers that have spread are really quite difficult to treat. And management due to this tends to be more focused on stopping spread of the disease, effectively halting disease progression, and where possible, trying to shrink and remove any of the distant metastases. So Heather's story, I think you're going to find, is really quite different to all of the others so far in this podcast series, because she's talking about stage 4 cancer. She's talking about living alongside her cancer diagnosis. Even 10 years ago, if you think back, people diagnosed with stage 4 cancer really didn't have the options that they have today. Huge steps have been made into cancer management. There are newer techniques, surgeries, targeted therapies, and there are options. People do survive cancer. In fact, around half of those diagnosed. But sadly, there are still those that don't. And then there's Heather, alongside 130,000 people in the UK alone living with metastatic cancer. For these people, there is no end. There's no end to the scans or the blood tests or the treatments. The treatment approach here is a little different to primary cancer. In stages 1 to 3, the big guns are pulled out to try and achieve some sort of permanent remission. The aim with secondary cancer is to use as little as possible to get the biggest effect. Whether that be radiotherapy, immunotherapy, chemotherapy or surgery, the aim is trying really to stabilise the disease. And then you remain on this therapy, this treatment path, essentially until it stops working. Then you move on to something else. So there are going to be times when the response is good, when the disease is stable, but equally there are going to be times, really scary times, when the disease is progressing. And the hope is that each therapy is going to last for as long as possible and that there will always be options for when it doesn't. So how do you manage mentally being in this limbo state? You've been told you have incurable cancer. You're not dying, but how do you live?
I think what I found really interesting about you and your story is that when different people are faced with such a devastating diagnosis of stage 4 cancer, whatever sort of cancer it is, I think a lot of people retreat and just go into themselves and become very introverted. Whereas if I'm right, I think you've done the opposite and you're trying to not only stay positive in terms of your thoughts and your beliefs and your attitudes, you're really trying to influence other people in doing the same. How are you managing to do that?
Well, let's back up to August of 2019. The medication that I was on at the time stopped working. I had disease progression and it was very sudden and very fast. I was on a dog walk on August 12th, and I am pretty sure my dogs actually walked me home. I got to my house, I was mumbling and slurring my words, and my wife immediately knew something was wrong. So she stood me up and we were sitting outside on our patio, and she stood me up and was trying to get me in the door when I had my first seizure. My disease progression was not in my lungs, it was in the brain metastases that I have. So they grew unchecked and was causing pressure in my brain, and it was going down my brainstem, and that's what caused the seizures. So when I had really my first lucid moment after 3 days in the hospital and suffering from 3 seizures, I knew that something had to change. I was merely surviving cancer. I was not living my best life with cancer, and I was not living my best life, period.
Was that the changing point for you whilst you were still in hospital, or was it some days or weeks or months afterwards that you had that realization?
It was definitely that first lucid day when I was in the hospital. I said, this is not right for me. This is not who I am. This is not the journey that I choose to take. Because like I said, I had been merely surviving with cancer. Did I think I was doing a good job? Yes, I did. But that really snapped me out of it and made me look back and realize, okay, these are the things that I've done. And while they are good, they are not the best version of myself. So when I got out of the hospital, I started a 30-day yoga challenge, and that catapulted me into where I am today. And I am the founder of the Thrive Tribe, and it's a membership where you are transforming your own experience with cancer, especially if you're like me, where I will not hear the words remission or no evidence of disease because I've got these pesky brain tumors. While they can't tell if they're alive or dead, my body still shows evidence of disease. And so it's become, you know, it started out with my journey and the mindset transformation that I had. And now I'm spreading the message to others because I do think, I don't know how it is in the UK, but in the US, doctors are not asking you, how are you doing mentally? How are you doing pursuing your dreams and your goals? And how is your identity as a cancer patient? And I think that's a very sad lack in healthcare in general, because yes, I am a cancer patient, but I am also a cancer thriver. And in order to be a thriver, I have to be living my best life.
That's really made me stop and think how I speak to patients who come and see me. And I think even now, if I say to somebody, I've got a lot of patients with cancer at various stages, as soon as they walk in the door, whether they're on their own or with somebody else, one of my first questions will always be, how are you? But I think it's so common that we don't really delve into sort of the mental side of things or how people are coping emotionally, that all I hear back is, well, this is my latest scan result, this is the treatment I'm on, these are the side effects. It goes straight back into that medical model, almost as if it's expected now.
I absolutely agree with you. And I do not rely on my doctor to do that for me. I have an amazing doctor. I absolutely adore him. He's the ALK specialist here in Denver. But I no longer expect him to do those things because I have done them for myself. And I hope to bring others along with me so that we can do it together.
And a journey's so much easier if you're not on your own doing it as well, isn't it? Especially if there's somebody there to be your supporter and your cheerleader who's already paved the way already.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that I learned pretty early on was that I needed an outside source to talk to. While my, you know, family is very supportive and they're very loving, if I was to go and say, you know, I'm having a rough day, their natural inclination is to try to make it better, to cheer me up. When sometimes you just want to sit in that space and say, I'm having a bad day. And that is okay. And I think only another cancer patient can really understand that and hold that space for you and say, it's okay to be where you are today.
Yeah, I don't think anyone else can actually, I certainly can't fully appreciate what it must be like knowing that you're, yes, you're living your best life, but you're still living your best life alongside a diagnosis of a stage four cancer. And I don't think anybody who's not lived a day in those shoes can actually appreciate what must go on inside of your own head.
It's, I think people can do it, but I think it's challenging. And I think there's a whole different set of conversations that happen with me, the cancer patient, and my people, the people that are around me, my family, my friends, my partner, it encompasses a lot of different types of conversations. And if I am not centered and balanced, I am not able to be, you know, my best self in these conversations. I am not able to best express my needs to my family and my friends and my partner. Same goes with talking to the medical professionals. You know, if I am not aware and centered and balanced and connected to my body, I can't go to my doctor and say, you know what, I really like this, I really dislike this. And you can tell your doctor, I think, a lot more when you're in touch with all of your physical body, your breathing and your thinking and, you know, your energy levels and your appetite. I think it takes work to get all of that put together so that it's in a good system, so that you can step forward and truly just really excel.
Do you think since you've developed this mindset that where you are more in tune with your physical self, are you able to detect changes in your body, or can you predict what the next scan might show purely because you're aware of your body and your symptoms and what it's essentially saying to you so much clearer?
That is a really good question. Wow. I am very aware of my breathing, and I can tell you right now it is very healthy. And I periodically and randomly will check it with a little oximeter, which you put on your finger and it tells you what your blood oxygen level is. I like to do that. It's just fun. What I didn't know was coming was the brain tumors. I didn't really have anything that indicated that. But I think now I might actually be able to detect something, and that will allow me to advocate for myself and tell my doctor, say, hey, something is not quite right. I think I need a scan.
That's really interesting. I've had patients come to me before they've been diagnosed and they can't tell me any symptoms. They just can tell me that something's wrong. And I wonder if they are just very mindful and in tune of their bodies as well, because 99% of the time, they're absolutely spot on.
I think it's totally possible, and it's a skill, and it's like a muscle to learn to listen to your body and listen to your intuition, because it does have messages for you. You just have to learn how to listen.
Yeah. Was there anybody who influenced you in terms of that moment? I'm just thinking of that first lucid moment when you're in the hospital bed. Had anyone spoken to you, or you'd heard somebody have similar ideas, or was there somebody who you looked up to, or was it purely you developed that lucid, clear moment yourself?
Well, it was kind of a two parts. One, my aunt was a two-time cancer survivor. She had breast cancer in the early 90s, and she went through those original sets of chemo, and they were very hard on her. She had a mastectomy. She recovered. She bounced back, and then she had liver cancer in the early 2000s. It was kidney. She had her kidney removed, and still, again, bounced back from that. And she was the one who taught me to live and laugh loud. You know, she was the one who I could look at and say, you know what? She overcame it, and she never faltered in her humor, in her grace, in dealing with it. And she taught me, passed away the January before I was diagnosed, but she taught me that in order to live your best life, you need to support your body and your mind and your soul. And everybody has to explore what that means for them. For me, that meant when I was diagnosed, I got my body supported by visiting a naturopath. I do acupuncture. I do Reiki. I am, you know, exploring Ayurveda. So these are the things that impact my physical body. Mentally, one of the first things I did was to find a therapist because I needed some place that was safe to talk and it wasn't leaving all of my mess with the people that I love. So I go to my therapist, I dump everything out, we pick through things, and I can leave it there. I've dealt with what I needed to deal with, and I can leave her the mess. I go home and I'm much better. And lastly, the spiritual or the soul side, everyone has their different beliefs, but your beliefs can be a foundation to help you integrate this mind and this body into a full expression of where you need to be.
Do you think, I don't know how to phrase this, do you think it's in some ways easier for people who have a stage 4 diagnosis who, as you said, aren't ever going to hear the words remission or no evidence of disease? Do you think it's easier to then be able to move to the more spiritual and mindfulness than perhaps somebody who's always chasing remission?
I think it's possible. I think that's when you're up against the wall of those words and facing your mortality, I think it pushes you to face those things. But I think all people, everyone, healthy and cancer patients alike, could benefit from looking your mortality in the face, because nobody's life is guaranteed. Something could happen at any moment, and you need to arrive at that moment peacefully and in total bliss by knowing that you have lived your best life.
I think so many of us are always trying to live in the future, aren't we? We're always trying to seek out and reach those goals and not quite happy or satisfied with what's in front of us. I think a lot of us could learn from your mindset and what you're saying.
Well, thank you. I think I'm trying to spread the message as far as and wide as I can. And if anybody will sit still for more than 5 seconds, I'm going to open up this box and invite them to look inside and poke around with me.
What are your top 3 tools or things to pull out of your box?
Oh, that's a good question. Meditation. I have a yoga studio membership and she puts up a meditation called a body scan. And I have found that to be rejuvenating. And it's also calming right before scans, which I think is funny. It's a body scan meditation and I'm scanning my body. And then I go to the hospital and have my body scanned again. That is absolutely one of my go-to. And the second one is walking my dogs around my neighborhood. They love it. I love it. I like to be out in nature peacefully and quietly. The neighborhood is very quiet during this time, especially. And the third thing is laughing with my partner. And we laugh a lot about everything.
It's true what they say, isn't it? About laughter being one of the best medicines.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And where are you in terms of your treatment journey? When you had your seizures, you'd alluded to the fact that the disease had progressed and that would mean that the targeted sniper would stop working. Have you changed to a different treatment program?
Yes. So when I was diagnosed, they had just come out with the first line treatment that was a targeted therapy for ALK positive, which was called Zelcori. And that one was very hard for me to handle because every body is different and I am a little person. And the dose that they gave me is the same dose that they would give, you know, I don't know the conversions, but a very large man. And I am not a large man. So I didn't tolerate that one very well. And they, you know, adjusted my doses and after about a year, a new medication came out. So my oncologist switched me to that one. And it was kind of the same cycle through and through and through until I was on the medicine that did not work very well for me, did not keep that disease in check. And I am now on the last of the five drugs currently on the market. And my oncologist put me on a lower dose to start because his theory is that should I have progression, he can up my dose just a little bit and it will help to manage any progression. Once this medication stops working, because it will, because the body's immune system, I don't know, the body is smart and the cancer is smarter. The cancer wants to do what it wants to do. I will be facing likely a traditional chemo route. However, I always say, like, there is no cure right now. There is no sixth option for me right now. But I truly believe that there will be, because I really believe that we're on the leading edge of a paradigm shift of what it looks like to be diagnosed with cancer and to live with cancer. When I was diagnosed, I didn't think I'd make it to like 3 years, and here I am at 4 years. And every year there's something new, there's something bigger, there's something better, there's something stronger.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think certainly from my experience, there are now way more people living with cancer than there are dying from cancer, which is massive in the last few years. And I don't think I ever thought that I would see that in my medical career. And that's just been in the last 5-10 years. So who knows what's around the corner?
That's exactly right. And I know that I am in that ALK positive outreach group on Facebook, which has all of the, well, it's not all, but ALK positive lung cancer patients from across the world. And people post their cancerversaries. And I'm seeing people that have survived 11 years, 9 years, you know, and I'm like, I could be that person. And it's not that far off, you know? And so that's kind of an aspiration of mine.
I think knowing that there are people out there with your same genetic markers, your same condition, and you can see them and their journeys so many years in the future must make you feel a lot more positive and, you know, like you say, have that as your aspiration to beat them, to have more years for the people following your story as well.
I agree. And that was part of the reason why I have started this membership and this community on Facebook. And it is why I'm doing what I'm doing, because when I was diagnosed, I went in search of someone whose story looked like mine. I didn't see anyone, not a single person. And I looked, and I'm a really good researcher. I didn't see anyone. And when I woke up in the hospital, it was A, some things got to change within myself, and B, I need to get my story out there so that somebody else who is on this journey can see a face that looks like theirs, or maybe a face that doesn't look like theirs, but gives them hope and also gives them something to think about that's just a little bit different.
Yeah, I think it's quite hard to find people with lung cancer stories. When I've been researching and doing a lot of research for the various different cancers I want to explore the journeys for this podcast, I'm finding it very hard in terms of lung cancer, of people telling their story about the early symptoms, about their treatment, about how they manage it. So I can only imagine how useful your group's going to be. And if it's all right, I'd like to post a link at the end of the podcast so people actually can find you and can find a community that they can get that support from.
Absolutely. I'd be so thrilled to have it linked. And I'd like to add that when you are diagnosed with lung cancer, it doesn't matter to people, when I explain to them, it's a genetic mutation. This is not something that I caused. There still is so much stigma around lung cancer. And the first question I always get asked is, did you smoke? And that is pointing the finger at me, blaming me for my condition. And that's not how it works. And that is a very painful thing to face. So I think it's very hard for people to talk about, I have lung cancer and I didn't smoke. There's always like this disclaimer that you have to say, because people automatically make an assumption, because that's what we've been told, is that lung cancer is preventable. Just don't smoke and you'll be fine. As I mentioned in the beginning, that's not true. Anyone with lungs, which is all of us, can get lung cancer.
That's such an important message for people to hear, because you're right, there's this stereotype of lung cancer and smoking that's everywhere, whether it's a medical model or, you know, one that the layperson can look at. But there's no other cancer out there that has such a strong link in people's mind that might be what's preventing people from sharing their story as well.
Yes. And I think also in the US, lung cancer is the least funded for research from our federal government and everywhere else, because there is this outdated notion that why would you research something that's preventable? Well, as I said, that's not true. And it's important for me and for a group of people that I've been working with that we change the dialogue around what it looks like to be diagnosed with lung cancer. I am not an 80-year-old man who smokes 5 packs a day, you know? So it's important for us to get our faces and our voices out there to help raise awareness, to help change the conversation, to help remove or reduce that stigma.
100%. I couldn't agree or have said it any better than you. I think a lot of particularly young people, if they have a persistent cough, won't even have lung cancer on their radar, because their first thought will be, I don't smoke. I've not been around anybody who's smoking all of the time. It can't be that. And that would probably prevent people from going to see their doctor to try and get that initial x-ray or some investigation started.
Absolutely. And you just have to listen to your body, like we talked about earlier. You have to know when your body is telling you there is something that is not quite right, and I need you to take action, go to the doctor. And if the doctor doesn't give you a satisfactory answer, which lucky for me, I had a very in tune primary care physician. But if your doctor is not giving you the results that you want, or you feel like they are blowing you off or brushing you, your concerns aside, you need to go someplace else. You need to advocate for yourself. There is nobody else that will do that job for you, and it is your responsibility. And I want to give everybody a permission slip to say, if you don't like what your doctor is telling you, find someone else. You get to choose who your medical team is.
Absolutely. And there are going to be doctors who pick up on the cues and the clues and are straight onto the diagnosis, and there are going to be ones that aren't. So yeah, there are plenty of medical professionals and doctors for people to go and get that second opinion and keep pushing, because like you say, there's only one person who's the advocate of your health, and it is yourself.
That's absolutely right. And there's been so many people that I have talked to that have said, I was misdiagnosed. It took a year. My doctor didn't listen. I was brushed off and blown off. And while I empathize with that and I understand it completely, I also have to ask the question, were you advocating for yourself? And you need to advocate for yourself. When I was diagnosed, I had an oncologist, at lung specialist here in Denver, and I did not like the woman. I just did not like her. And so I fired her essentially. And I went and found a new oncologist. While his bedside manner was terrible, he was probably the smartest person that I'd ever met. And when he announced his retirement, I went to the ALK specialist here because it was time for me to do so. Yeah. But those were actions that I had to take myself.
I've got one final question for you, if that's all right. Is there something that you know now that you wish that you had known back then?
Yes, without a doubt. I wish I knew back then that no one in the medical field would ask me about myself as Heather, not as a cancer patient or Heather the cancer patient or Heather the 34-year-old with lung cancer. They wouldn't ask how I was doing mentally, how I was feeling about myself and my identity, things like my values and my dreams. Someone should be asking those questions. We should be asking each other these questions. We should be asking ourselves these questions. And I want to ask these questions of your listeners today, because I want you to know that the answers to those questions are seen and they are heard. You are so much more than a cancer patient, a cancer survivor, or a cancer thriver. You are uniquely and beautifully and wonderfully you. I want people to know that they can keep on shining, and I will be here in Denver sending sparkly fist bumps, because that's the most valuable gift that I can give.
I love your sparkly fist bumps, and I think everybody listening, I hope they rewind that bit and listen to it again and actually think about it and soak it in and realize how important that message is. You've been absolutely incredible, and I think not just to patients listening and people listening and hopefully understanding their bodies a bit better, but to health professionals, I think your message is so clear and important that we hear and we take it on board what you're saying. So thank you so much.
Well, it was my pleasure to be here today, and it really is an honor to be here as a new face of lung cancer and to ask these questions and to help think about living life with cancer.
Everything is new again, walking with the permigrin, head so high. I'm back with you and all is right. Shaking on the apple tree, ticking off the honeybees, watch them fly. It's just like we never said goodbye. I will not let you let me down. I will not let you let me down. This time, this is my final.